like, I know for a fact in Japan that this is that Amanita
muscaria.
Yeah.
It's David Arora tells a great story about that, of a family stepping on boletes. And he was like, what is going on? And then he saw them with their bags of Amanitas. He's like, what happened to those boletes? And they're like, we wanted to make sure no one got those bad mushrooms. And he was like, those are porcini. What are you doing? Well, this is honestly a perfect lead-in. I started the timer, and this is now the show, because Ian started dropping knowledge. So we are here. We are with Ian Bollinger of Oakland Hyphy and many other organizations. I want to say mycologist, chemist, psychedelic philosopher, pioneer, maybe Pokemon master, you know, many different titles. We are here broadcasting from KPCA Studios in Petaluma, Public Access in Petaluma. Ian, thank you so much for joining us in person on the Mushroom Hour.
I am blessed to share this space with you. This is the first time I got to be here physically. I've got to see a couple of our mutual friends, William Padilla Brown, come through here. Tomas come through here with Mike Ozine. I'm really honored to be here, man. Like, this is a blessing in so many ways.
The honor is all mine that you would make the trip. I'm excited for everything. And like I said, we rolled into the show because you were just dropping bombs. So let's keep going with it. So last time we spoke, we were talking about the Hyphy Cup. And that was the first one. It's been that long. We were talking about the first one, and obviously you guys have grown exponentially. Mycelia did exponentially since then, but I know you've got your hands in a couple other pots as well. So give us the breakdown since that period. What's going on with Oakland Hyphy? What other projects are you started, programs you're involved in?
So right now, Oakland Hyphy is doing, I'll talk about what's happening currently. And yes. Then we can look back at the reflection as to where it was since the last time we were with the first cup.
Okay, I like that.
So we're actually doing, in the midst, the final bit of the data crunch. Like, we're getting all the last bit of samples for this year's cup. We used to be doing them twice a year. Now we're doing them once a year. We announce in December. We're doing a digital event this December. I think it's the 19th that we're doing it.
And for the Hyphy Cup, maybe give the quick synopsis of what that is, because we probably have some new listeners. Absolutely. I'm assuming everyone knows about the Hyphy Cup, of course.
That's fair.
What is the Hyphy Cup?
Again, talking about insular communities.
Yeah.
The Hyphy Cup is the first entheogenic mushroom competition, I would argue, that we put together back in, wow, time flies. We started this in 2021 at the start of COVID. Wow, time flies. And so the way it's worked is we've asked people to submit entheogenic mushrooms from, you know, psilocybin-containing mushrooms as well as cordyceps and extracts as well to have them compared for potency levels. And we started conversations around what are we talking about when we're talking about these mushrooms as far as dosage, because there needs to be conversations around harm reduction. And this is one of the biggest things that we've learned and gotten the support from the city of Oakland to be able to continue to pursue and been able to, just like we're in a beautiful public access space right now, we've been able to move into a similar space for science. Slope Labs is an amazing location near the airport in Oakland that has been willing to house not just Hyphy and the Cup, but also the Center for Mycological Analytics, which is this new, for lack of a better term, educational platform that we've put together where we can teach people the skills necessary to go from a dried cordyceps, like dried cordyceps in their hands, and in a lab space, go to HPLC data and all the steps in between, extraction, analysis, and then furthermore discussion about that data.
So getting the active compounds that are in your mushroom, that kind of chemical analysis out of your dried specimen, that is the dream. I know so many people would love to have that superpower and be able to do that.
And our goal is to speak to a bunch of different layers of people. Right now, I think we're speaking a lot more to the enthusiasts as far as our educational, our ability to apply our educational skills. But every time we teach a class, we reiterate. We try to add some input from the previous courses to be able to make it more accessible. And furthermore, we're working on getting expanded out into other languages as well.
You guys are getting the format you need to make this kind of like a modular class, repeatable class, like a template.
That's the hope. Yeah. The idea is, again, to build these communities. So we've built the community in Oakland this past summer.
Yeah.
We taught three courses out of this space. We had, I believe, a total of 21 in our students in three different cohorts. We had people who never graduated high school that are cultivators to PhDs from large universities.
Amazing.
All in the same course. My favorite picture is a member from the Richmond community, an indigenous young scientist who showed up to lab and was wearing glasses, lab coat, gloves, processing mushrooms, wearing a hat that said, "You are on indigenous land."
That is an incredibly potent symbol.
It was, and that's everything we want to represent with our space.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we're trying to empower people. Like, my goal is to have somebody be able to say, the skills you taught me helped me get a job.
Well, and doesn't that talk about the this potential of science? The potential of science is like a liberating force and a discipline we can all engage in. Literally does not matter at all what your background is. We can all engage in this.
And this is the idea behind citizen science.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that we're empowering people to recognize, as William Padilla Brown likes to say, the human body is a scientific instrument.
Yes, we are. I love that. Yeah.
And better understanding that we are scientists fundamentally.
Yeah.
And as, I mean, to quote Rick and Morty, one of my favorite quotes is, you know, sometimes people forget that science is more art than science.
Ooh.
Because it's science true. It wraps around. It's an Ouroboros. You know, it's eating its own tail, kind of a thing. Like, it's an infinite loop. Again, this philosophizing kind of a space.
I just had Britt Bunyard pop in my head. He's like, science is just asking questions, and there are so many questions we haven't asked. So there, yeah, it is literally, I love that. It's why we're here. We are here to engage in science, to examine our environment, ask questions, learn about it.
As I like to think about, comedians are modern philosophers.
Mm.
I mean, who else do you pay cash money to go listen to them speak?
Give you some truths, yeah.
And then you get thrown out if you interrupt them?
That is very Aristotelian.
It's very, and it's and honestly, and I think good comedy takes you to the edge of the absurd and makes you laugh at it.
Right.
And it shows you the darkness in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what makes a good philosopher. Satire has been known to really draw forth some good philosophy. And that being said, there's the American philosopher, rest in peace, Bill Hicks. You know, we are the universe trying to understand itself subjectively.
Right.
You know, I think that was his bit from a young man has a positive experience on acid, a positive drug story. Whatever happened to those, you know, it's like a positive drug stories. You know, on news, a young man discovered that we are all energy, all matter is energy condensed to a slower vibration, that we are all the universe understanding itself subjectively.
Right. Let's do some of the positive trips. Well, so you guys are embodying some of this, like, wisdom that we just laid down, quoted. You guys are kind of embodying it with the space there at Slope Labs.
We're trying to empower people because it's no, not no. It's K-N-O-W, not N-O. And I'm trying to flip the script on, I'm a big script flipper kind of a guy. I'm trying to flip the script on this idea of gatekeeping.
Hmm.
It's not gatekeeping. The opposite side of that coin, that has like a negative connotation to it.
Right.
The opposite side of that coin to me is guardianship.
Ooh.
And that is, I'm protecting the thing because it can be dangerous. And I'm protecting you to make sure that when you come to the thing, you have the right knowledge about it.
Right. As an adept, you must come forth and learn from someone who has gone before into the unknown territory. Yeah.
It's at least a step in the direction I think is important.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and recognizing that, you know, there is an important necessarily, like, barriers between certain conversations.
And certain prerequisite knowledge, right? There's certain levels of discipline and fundamental knowledge you need to really engage in this process productively and be able to understand, like, what you're doing and why. And we were just talking before the show, that's one of the barriers I find in reading some papers sometimes. And I think sometimes that's why our ideas around mushroom biology and community ecology, when it involves fungi, we start getting almost magical thinking about it. And I think it's because people like me, people who are interested, who come at this just from mycology, are missing some fundamental knowledge of biology and chemistry that could help demystify that and really give us a better understanding of why things are operating the way they are.
It's beautiful because the internet, like we were talking earlier, allows us to connect and find these people that are just as obsessed about this thing that we are. Because I was listening to Hamilton Morse's podcast with Alan Rockefeller recently, and he gave this beautiful intro where he was talking about, you know, it's like, I will never ask Alan how he got into mushrooms. It's obsession.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and we have those people that can share the wealth of that knowledge. Like, I have my own obsession about the chemistry, the biochemistry, the genetics, which I'll talk about here in a bit, as well with the Entheogen Genome Foundation, the nonprofit that we've recently been able to work together with Vanderbilt University to get a publication out.
Amazing. All right. So actually, I think we can do a through line to that, because I would imagine this comes out of the efforts of the Hyphae Cup, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these compounds, so when you guys are putting together this competition to analyze the active compounds in entheogenic mushrooms, it's my understanding we don't have necessarily baselines of some of these compounds. On where, you know, on chromatography, and you can correct me if I get things wrong, but on chromatography, we don't have baselines on like what the peaks are at what times and what compound that translates to for some of these tryptamines, right?
One of the more interesting conversations is to have with a gentleman named Jordan Jacobs. Mm. If you're not familiar with him, he is the gentleman, a second author on the publication that I'm referencing, worked together with Dr. Dusty Rose Miller out of Vanderbilt University to work on a Zapotecorum, which is Psilocybe Zapotecorum, which is a Central American mountainous psilocybe species.
Okay.
And looked at how to cultivate it, because it's not been known to be able to be very cultivated easily indoors or in vitro versus in vivo.
Right.
And furthermore, looking at its chemical profiles and its genetics. But he's got some interesting things to say about wood lovers, because pan-cyans can tend to have some interesting peaks that I see as well, that I don't necessarily know what they are. You know, it's like it's showing up in this interesting range, and it may play a role in wood lover's paralysis, but nobody has answers to this right now, you know?
And back up a little bit,
Paniolus cyanescens. Sorry.
Okay.
I appreciate you wanting me to. I'm
going to pretend like this is for the listeners, but no, this is also for me.
No, I appreciate you. Paniolus cyanescens is also a wood-loving species of mushroom, not in the psilocybe genera.
Okay.
So genus and species. Psilocybe is the genus, and cubensis would be the species. Zapotecorum would be the species.
Right.
And so then we also have like Paniolus.
Yes.
Which is another species which have both psychedelic or entheogenic mushrooms and non-entheogenic mushrooms.
Okay. And so you're seeing some compounds within that that you don't know how to place. So I would guess it's not, I believe you guys have like 17 tryptamines mapped out, if I had that right.
Right now we're pushing, we have a total of about 20 compounds.
Yeah.
That we're currently 18 guaranteed, 20 I just got in and I'm lining up, but those are not tryptamines. They're for muscarin and ibotenic acid. I'm just double checking. We got a new method.
So we might be expanding into.
We have. We've been doing that. I actually got a one fresh one that I'm going to be teaching, hopefully doing an extract with the class in December that we're teaching with the Center for Mycological Analytics. And so it's like the 17 tryptamines that we're looking at, and I'm including beta carbolines as because they are tryptamines as well. And that's a different conversation to have. It's like a subset of tryptamines, if you will.
Got it.
And then we're including those. We also have nucleosides like corticepin and adenosine.
Okay.
And then we also have the compounds that we would find in Amanita muscaria, ibotenic acid and musk mole. Muscarin is a little bit more interesting because of its structure. It has a unique charge state to it. And so it tends not to be very easily analyzable with our current method. To touch back on what you said earlier, we don't really have a good baseline about what this conversation is. And so this is why I love being able to work with people like Jordan Jacobs or our sister lab that Hyphae Labs has been working with in Colorado, Tryptomix, to be able to not just duplicate our analysis on the same samples, but also to be able to have conversations about what is a better extraction method, what is the best analysis method, and then furthermore, how can we make this a baseline available to people, which was missing from like the cannabis space, and how can we make sure that the people that are moving into the mushroom space have the skill sets to not have the wool pulled over their eyes as scientists.
I've heard this, that the testing space in cannabis got overrun with people that were not necessarily fudging results, but giving results that, you know, they know certain people wanted potentially. So that's really interesting. And you said on past episodes on how much you learned from that, and actually the process, you know, so many people have heard about psychoactive mushroom decriminalization, and it's in the collective consciousness now. And you were very clear that, look, the next step, if we're going to do this responsibly as a society, the next step is identifying compounds and levels and being able to test it, because individuals within a species obviously could vary wildly. So it's almost like it would be nice to have this kind of testing to be widespread, because you are going to have so much variation sample to sample as this kind of moves out. So really, really interesting. And for, again, just to define a couple terms or give a little context, all of what we're talking about identifying compounds, taking a dried specimen. Is it all through a chromatography process? Or just talk about like the equipment a little bit, just that overview of the equipment and what the output is, because I think some people have seen the colors, the spikes of different colors on a chromatographer, and time is like a necessary dimension. At different times, certain things trigger a result. Mm-hmm. So give, I don't want to, that could take episodes and episodes.
But I'll
give
do
that
my breakdown. Best elevator pitch on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the biggest concept that we're going from is a dried mushroom. So like we'll get our cordyceps fruits, and we're going to break them up into as much of a similar powder as we can. Like we want to make the powder what we call homogeneous.
Yeah.
Homogeneous, make the same. And so once we homogenize the mushroom into a nice powder, we're then going to extract it out. And in the class, we do three different extraction solutions so we can allow the people to be able to look at how each of those solutions extract the same compounds from the same fruit differently.
I see.
That's okay. One of those aha moments that we like to add in, because it's like if you're a cultivator and you want to make a tincture, or you're trying to do analysis. Those are two different questions that might require two different extractions. And so by doing the three different extraction methods, we can say, oh, well, if our goal is to get everything out so we can analyze everything and make sure we're not leaving stuff behind in our analysis, or if we're just trying to make something that's human consumable.
Interesting. So there's a different extraction technique for each. Okay, and so this has evolved, and you talked about baselines. Is it correct to say that, you know, for these tryptamines, yeah, there is no baseline. So, and I don't want to ask a question that reveals like, well, that's our secret sauce. That's the whole.
You won't. You trust me.
You'll back me down. You'll be like, no, I can't tell you that. But just, yeah, how do you go about that? How can you say, well, that's this compound when looking at a result like that?
So once we have our powdered mushroom and our extraction solution,
yeah,
what we're going to do is we're going to filter that extract, and then we're going to take a very, 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 very small amount, like 3 microliters, 10 microliters, like yeah, itty bitty bitty bits of this. And then we're going to inject that into what I like to think of as like a solvent river. Have you ever been to a water park and gone to like a lazy river?
Yes.
You know, you get in and it just takes you around, and eventually it takes you back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if you can imagine a unidirectional one, like you're at the top of the hill and you make it down to the bottom of the hill.
Yes. Okay.
And then you have to walk all the way back up if you want to do it again. So you get in at the top, and if you have an inner tube and I don't, we both get in at the same time. You're going to be slowed down by other people in inner tubes.
Right.
I'm not. I'm going to slip through. And that's one form of how we can separate things in the system. So we're going to inject our sample in, and the compounds are going to get separated either by size or by interaction. Like interacts with like. So people in inner tubes are going to bounce off of each other, and they're going to interact with each other more. Versus me, I don't have an inner tube. I can just slip through.
I see. So some of these compounds, you do have baselines, I would imagine, to be able to isolate. Okay.
Some.
Yeah, we see, you know, this compound, this one's a mystery, let's figure out.
You said 16, that's 16, 17? Yeah. We're talking about when people run these samples on high-end instrumentation.
Yeah.
They see 1,000 peaks, 1,000 individual compounds that could be looked at individually. And we're looking at 18.
Yeah, well, what are you... So you're looking at... Is there like a grouping of tryptamines?
There is. And we're looking specifically at the ones that are typically found in entheogenic mushrooms.
Okay.
Our biggest goal is to bridge the gap between research being done on depression or PTSD.
Right.
At like Johns Hopkins. They're utilizing pure psilocybin in their research. The issue is that's hard to translate to actual fruit mushrooms. And so our goal is to help bridge that gap in some kind of meaningful way. So it's like we can tell a person there's this many milligrams of psilocybin in your fruit or in your extract. So now you know that if I consume this many milligrams of it, I will get this, like I can consume 100 milligrams of my mushroom.
Right.
That's a microdose.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, oh, if I took 200, well, that's a little bit much. And I know that because I can see how many milligrams of psilocybin it is.
Yeah, an absolutely essential element. And that's why it always begs the question for me, there must be institutional labs looking at this, I would imagine.
There are. And most of the for-profit labs keep a lot of that information to themselves. I know Field Trip was doing research on this at one point in Jamaica. Mm. I mean, there's a number of Canadian companies that are keeping a lot of stuff under lock and key because it's intellectual property.
Right.
And so there's a lot of, I mean, I know that there are other people doing work. Denver had a recent entheogenic cup and they had 500 samples come in and they tested theirs and they put all the data out for public access. That's the way. Like this is what needs to be available, because somebody that's going to go somewhere in Denver or wherever these people are getting the mushrooms from need to know, oh, if I get this from this person, like if I get a ape, I'm not going to say the full name because public access.
Right.
You're welcome. If I'm going to get an ape, it's going to be far more likely to be highly potent. And I would want to take less of it compared to something that's like a golden teacher, which is very much of a typical potency. And that's somewhere in the realm of about like 7 milligrams, 6 milligrams per gram.
Yeah.
And if you think about that, okay, well, if I have something that's 6 milligrams per gram, I'm going to take about 100 milligrams of that.
Yeah.
That's somewhere in the realm of like 1.5 milligrams of psilocybin right there.
Yeah.
And that's the ideal starting point. That's a good microdose. That's a good entry point. And that's kind of what we built our hyphae spectrum for, the hyphae cup.
Yes.
These different categories or buckets by which we can talk about use. There's people that might want to get into microdosing. They don't want to ever macrodose their microdose.
Right.
You know, there are people that just want to go to a museum or a concert and enjoy themselves, but they don't want to question universal math.
Yeah. And I think there is an element of that. The cannabis industry pushed us to, let's get the highest amount of whatever the most psychoactive compound is. And I love that you guys, I've used that so many times, talking about the hyphae spectrum. Like, flip this hierarchy on its side and let's look at everything for its own properties and not try to create like a primacy or a supremacy of one or the other. So I think that's very interesting. And of course, the context of this, as you've already laid out, is all safety and responsible use. As these things get more public, I mean, you can't go anywhere now without hearing someone talking about microdosing. You bring up the word mushroom, it's like some middle-aged mom you'd never expect is like all over it. So this is really important to have this be the center of the conversation if we're going to do this responsibly.
Literally, I know there was a showing of our data that we produced on Dr. Phil.
There was.
Yeah.
I saw that.
Yeah.
It made me so happy.
Moms Who Microdose, I think was it. But that being said, also we've discussed about the spectrum from the entheogenic side. We also are talking about things from the cordyceps side.
Yeah.
Tell
us about that.
Yeah. There's a conversation to have about dosage use categories.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's something to be said for levels of cordycepin. So we have a theoretical spectrum that we've based off of number of publications that have done work on, you know, people consuming cordyceps mushrooms in specific quantities according to specific regimes. And there are cases of increased, you know, aerobic activity. So being able to hold more air in our lungs and not feel exhausted.
This is the 1990 women's Chinese track team Olympic story that got cordyceps so famous in the Western world. Yeah.
And so our preliminary spectrum that we've been working for cordyceps is something that it's not released yet. We're going to be talking about it in this December. And releasing that information out to the public, because it's again, just like the original spectrum for Cubensi or for entheogenic compounds was hopefully a conversation starter. Where I'm not claiming that this is it.
Yeah.
I'm claiming that this is where we should at least start the conversation. I think that there's some use categories that we can talk about. Sometimes you just want to have aerobic capacity, but sometimes you also want immunoactivity. You want increased immune response, being able to handle things better if you're getting sick. And there is certain research that's been done with cordyceps in that way as well. And so we're increasing that information, putting that information out there. And this is something that we want to be able to tie back together based off of, we're taking research, just like we did with the Johns Hopkins research, tied it to quantifiable data.
Yeah.
And then brought this information to the public saying, we're not saying this is the answer. We're saying this is a place where we can start. This is a nice intersection of experience and data that we can at least provide for the community. And I think that's the goal of not just what we did with the cup, but also what we're trying to do with, because I mean, Hyphae Labs helped found the Center for Mycological Analytics. And what we're trying to teach people, it's like the next generation. Like the people came into the cannabis industry as a scientist. That's what I started at. I had no experience working with a plant. Because you can't get experience working
with a plant. Of course, right. Right.
You know, unless you're doing it illicitly.
It's federally regulated, yeah.
And so because there are spaces where there has been decriminalization, there are spaces for us to be able to offer people the opportunity to get exposed to this science. And that is the idea. Again, like if somebody can say, you know, I got a job because I took the course, I learned something in this course that gave me the knowledge and the confidence in my ability to be able to say, no, I can do this. I know what's best to use in this instance. We're making a tincture. Your company's making a cordyceps tincture.
Yeah.
I can tell you I've done the work. I've got first principle data. You know, it's not just theoretical, you know, and that's the idea, is to empower people. It's that teach a man to fish, you know, it's like
100%.
And this is the teach a person to fish is the community. It's like you're teaching your community these skills. So our idea is education. No, not no. And this is empowering on a lot of levels because we're looking at Lion's Mane as well. There's a number of different groups that are interested in answering some of these questions that, you know, sesquiterpenoids, what a fun word, but it's just, it's a fun thing to think about. It's like all of these compounds we talk about, flavonoids or terpenes.
Terpenes, right.
And these are the things that we're just now talking about in cannabis.
Yeah.
Like we're just now, it's like, oh, it took us 10 years to get here,
right.
But we're finally having this conversation. Thankfully, people are also having this conversation about mushroom terpenes.
Yep.
And this is something that we need to play a role because honestly, and this is something Alan Rockefeller is a genius for pointing out, that some of these mushroom terpenes are inhibitory to the experience that you might have on entheogens. And the same is true about inhibitory of cordyceps.
Well, and I've heard, we had Robert Rogers on the show years ago now, but he talked about terpenes as being critical to raising the immune response of HK cells, HK white blood cells in the body, which I thought was fascinating because we hear so much about immune boosting. These mushrooms are immune boosting. We walk around the grocery store, that's like, mushrooms are immune boosting. It's like, well, what? How are they boosting
the immune system? This is an antioxidant. It's just like, what is it?
Like, yeah, but like, what is it doing to do that? And so it's interesting to hear about. Yeah, there's the primary metabolites, just fancy sugars that break down into pieces our white blood cells can use to build more.
Mm-hmm.
But then the terpenes is the secondary metabolite as, oh, this raises the vigilance response of HK cells. Super, super interesting.
It's beautiful because, again, dose-dependent responses. There's something to be said for stimulating our immune system, not getting sick, but stimulating it in a way as if we were sick, kind of a thing. It's not like you're not getting the illness because you have something producing compounds, but you're introducing these things that stimulate these systems, just like a muscle. You gain better muscle by working that muscle, by stimulating that. The same is true about thinking as well. You obsess about a thing, you get better at that thing, to tie it kind of back together, you know, as above, so below.
That's right.
As within, so without. So these lessons that we can learn from mushrooms can also translate to our own life lessons.
Well, I'm thinking about it. I mean, what you guys are doing is, this is kind of the future because so much of, when you think about the medicinal space, and I just talked about all the store shelves, how many of these companies are really testing their compounds? You know, you go to that wholesaler bringing in mushrooms from overseas, which is understandable because a huge portion of mushrooms are grown overseas, specifically in China. And it's like, do we have the QC? Do people have the chemical analytical capacity to say, is what you're giving me what you say? How potent is it really? And I mean, that's going to be so important. It's hard for me now to take medicinal supplement stuff seriously, just because once you learn enough, you're like, I don't know that you've really verified any of this. So this would seem to be the next step. Not only we're talking about safety and using entheogens, but for the commercial element mm-hmm. of using mushrooms as a medicinal mm-hmm. or as a supplement, needs this to kind of reach legitimacy.
Specifically, like, there are people that are in the Lion's Mane space again mm-hmm. that are trying to push these conversations forward, because there are some people that are like, I'm only producing a water extract. I'm doing an alcohol extract. Right. I'm doing a combo dual extract. I'm using a Soxhlet extractor. I mean, all of these different methods or means of extraction
yeah.
that people are choosing to go down the paths. We are still in the infancy. Again, remember that 18 compounds versus 1,000 unknowns? Yeah. We're literally in a very similar space with lion's mane and cordyceps. Like, there are so many unanswered questions and so much low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
But the issue is there's not real big money in science. Like, I'm praying for the day that Alan Rockefeller gets a private investor that, like an old world, like, Renaissance patron.
Yeah,
which right. is, like, here's $1 million every year, build a lab, fund a team, make it work for 10 years. You know, it's yeah. like, that would be beautiful, because I know whatever comes out of that is going to be...
Hint, hint to all the angel investors listening.
If there isn't yeah. one already going, that should happen.
Right.
And that being said, it's just like looking at other people in the space, like you could talk about, you know, private companies investing into individuals. I think that's important, because now that individual, while they're funded privately, are able to still do their own thing.
Well, and this is interesting, because this has such a tangible output, I would think, for a profit-driven, investor-driven, like, we have thousands of compounds we're staring at that we don't know what they are. Don't you want to know what this, I mean, the next level of bioprospecting is here, and you could be a part of it. Have you guys ever thought of that with Hyphy Labs? I mean, I'm sure you've thought of it, but has that, what's been the conversation around that?
So Hyphy Labs has always been centered around providing data for the cultivator and the individual.
Yeah.
Center for Mycological Analytics is going to be the space where we want to reach down and do this, like, vetting. Like, there's papers that come out on mushrooms. We want to be like, okay, well, let's look at the methods that we're teaching people and the methods explained in this paper.
Yeah.
Let's do a side-by-side. And then let's actually say, oh, well, our method is better at getting these compounds out than these compounds, or their method is better at doing this one thing than, like, less time, less solvent waste. You know, it's like, these are interesting things that we're trying to bring together and inform conversations around
yeah.
with the Center for Mycological Analytics. Hyphy Labs is very much centered around providing the data to the people that is accessible and necessary. Not many people care about these baocystin, norbaocystin, these psilocybin-like compounds that are in entheogenic mushrooms. People really, like, they are geared to only care about, just like with cannabis, THC.
Right.
And it took a long time for the conversation to expand to these other compounds. Our hope is to, just because at a base level we do that, like, we give everybody the full profile of everything yeah. that we're testing. We're not like, oh, you have to, you know, selectively pay more for that full profile. So no, you get everything up front, because that's important to dosage. Like, understanding, it's like, oh, well, if we think about these psilocybin-like compounds, if they don't have an entheogenic effect, which is what is science is showing,
yeah,
they can interfere with the breakdown of the entheogenic compounds.
They replace... I see.
Like, the yeah. monoamine oxidase is going to look for psilocybin-like compounds. Well, it's going to have, if it has three options of norbaocystin, baocystin, and psilocybin, right. it's going to select each one.
Your monoamine oxidase is getting filled up with, yeah, interesting.
It's the mucking up the gears.
Right.
And so having amounts of those other compounds at bare minimum play a role in that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's, again, it's like we're talking about something that is far more complex.
Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
we're, again, infancy of this.
But maybe a process that is kind of integral to the experience of your microdosing, your medicinal experience. So yeah, a lot of conversations to be had around that. I remember I asked that in our last interview to you and Tomas and Reggie, like, do you guys think there's a cohort effect with other compounds in the mushrooms? And you're like, yes, of course. Of course that's the case.
Yeah.
But we don't fully understand that, and that's part of this work. So yeah, talk a little bit about then this offshoot, the Center for Mycological Analytics. And I just butchered the name.
No, but you didn't. That was it.
That's it. Yeah, Mycological Analytics.
Yeah. It's a long one. It is a tongue twister. We call it CIMA.
CMA.
CMA? CMA okay. for short.
Perfect. How did the center come together? Who's involved in that? Is it like the whole Hyphy crew or... Yeah, talk about that.
So Reggie, Emily Davis, and myself founded it. Emily and I are the instructors and the board right now. We are working together to... We've taught classes in Oakland. We are working to start teaching these classes around. We're trying to get funding to be able to support an instrument that we can bring into other communities, both to teach around and to show people, like, if we can build a space for you with this kind of instrument, we will teach your people how to do the work. And now you can provide the data for your community, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Like building these spores in different communities.
Decentralized network of testing.
And our goal is to create like this network of education and platforms of people that have learned how to do this, and that there's space that is educational, like in decriminalized spaces. We're talking to groups in Detroit to hopefully be able to bring this there. Our goal is to hopefully expand out to places like Portland, where that's going to be needed. Like, there are people that are going to be working for labs out there that would benefit greatly from having the skill set, at least having at least a baseline of what the conversation's around. And as places decriminalize, we want to be able to help inform and educate the communities there as to what testing could look like.
So you're informing people in the communities where decriminalization has happened. So these substances, psychoactive mushrooms, are out there. You're informing them, getting, but then you're also training a generation of analytical chemists. I mean, that's so cool for people who have chosen the professional track already. They're like, well, I really want to get into this, but yeah, there's no way I can work with it. Boom, suddenly they've got an avenue. But then on the other side, to flip the script, you're also going to be teaching people who are like, I have no interest in being a chemist, but I love these mushrooms.
I'm a cultivator. I've been working with cordyceps for the past year and a half, and I've been making this food product out of this one thing. I want to know, is our food product actually have active compound in it?
Right. And then suddenly they're like, I am an analytical chemist now. I love this. That's so cool.
And it's beautiful because the group that we worked with, Mycelial Mass, which is based out of Slope Labs.
Yeah, okay.
They are working on a different products, like different cordyceps-based things that are all cordyceps, like entirely just different parts of the cordyceps. And those different things that they make, they can now test. Like they have the space. We've taught the people how to do it, and we can work together to make sure it gets on the instrument and the analysis happens. We can discuss it, and now they have an informed process. There are other people that are doing this as well through Hyphae Labs that are informing, like their entire products are informed by the data that we provide. And that's the idea, is we're trying to grow community knowledge and empower people to, it's like you're a cultivator and you want to understand how to read the report. Well, we'll help you make one.
Yeah.
And in that process, you'll learn how to read it.
For any of us who see the potential, both in entheogenic mushrooms as a medicinal, but then mushrooms more broadly, again, this is the key piece I feel that is missing, is like, all right, this is now legitimate. We've done testing. We know what's actually going on. We can tie those compounds to effects instead of kind of marketing puffery. You say Mycelial Mass, my brain gets triggered. Is Seth involved in this or any of the team from Bay Area Applied Mycology?
I know... There's two people, I'm not sure the history of these things.
Very okay, well. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know there's two people that I can speak to that are directly involved. Okay, cool. Mario Giabatti.
Yes, okay, Mario was doing stuff with BAM as well. Okay,
yeah, cool. And then Hart Singer. And Hart is, shout out Hart. Hart is a blessing and a hardworking of a bioinformatician. He's a lab scientist that teaches DNA barcoding, has learned, taught himself how to do high-end DNA barcoding, works for this amazing group called Fundus, the Fungal Diversity Survey, who he's allowed me to work with them as well. It's been beautiful to be able to support some of their bioinformatics work, but Hart is one of those people that has supported, you know, Mario, Mycelial Mass, Entheome. Like, he's just an amazing human being, and I just want to give him a huge shout-out.
Huge shout-out to Hart. Huge shout-out to Fundus. We've had them on the show before. What an amazing organization.
Yep.
And always what's in need is more chemistry, more people who can practice the chemistry. If we're going to discover new mushrooms, if we're going to find out, I mean, 2.5 million species, do you think we've mapped out a fraction of what is in any of these mushrooms?
So blessed to be able to speak to, I hope I'm not butchering his name because it's a very fun spelling, Scott Ostuni out of Florida, just recently discovered a new species of psilocybe.
Incredible.
Yeah. And I mean, Alan's doing it left and right. I think he's got
He makes it look easy.
Yeah, people think
like, I'm going to discover a mushroom because he did.
Well, and it's just one of those, you know, Scott was observing that, you know, it looked like, I think he was saying, looked like Psilocybe natalensis. But when they ran the DNA on it, it came out as a completely different species. And so they're like, oh, well, we need to do this thing. So he worked together to get funding and got funding to support its full genome through the Entheogen Genome Foundation, which is a nonprofit that I've helped work with Victor Mosty from Mexico, as well as Jason Slott at Ohio State, Alan Rockefeller, and Kane Barlow in Australia, who's an amazing human being. If you're not familiar with Kane and Alistair, I will see if I can't get you in touch with him. That's a fun conversation.
Well, it's funny. You're laying out this ecosystem of people that I hadn't heard of yet that are like core figures in mapping out. I mean, I would assume the genetic conversation, the entheogen conversation. I mean, what I talked about a few years ago on the Mushroom Hour is like, oh, there are these community science groups that are going to come up and support, I don't want to say surpass, but support or directly collaborate with institutional science. And all the professors I had spoken with are like, yep, totally. We see it. It's already happening.
You're talking about it happening. You prophesied it, friend. Like, you saw it coming.
Well, I listened to what smarter people were saying, which is a gift. But yeah, that's amazing to hear that it's happening.
Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very, very thankful. Entheum has done 2 trips down to Mexico, where we've invited people together to go out and do wild forages with the community down there. So it's just as many international members. We try to bring in local community members as well. And our goal is to not just go out and find these mushrooms, but do DNA work on them as well.
Amazing.
And one of the things that we're very thankful for, Dusty Rose Miller, Jordan Jacobs, Hart, myself, Alan Rockefeller, Dr. Jason Slott, we're all able to, that's not even the full list, I don't believe, we're able to work together on a publication specifically on Psilocybe zapotecorum, which was supported by the Entheogen Genome Foundation's full genome that we were able to run to support them. Like, that's the thing, it's beautiful to be able to get this data out there in a public good, you know, to make this available. And some of the insights that we're getting, you know, I could talk about all of the different fingerprints that are different amongst, you know, Zapotecorum is close to Mexicana, but they're different than Cubensis. Tampanensis, which comes from Tampa, is closer to Mexicana than it is to Cubensis. You know, it's like, and there are interesting fingerprints, and that's just having to do with the gene clusters that are associated with entheogenic
production. The phylogeny of Psilocybe.
And I even look at other species. So we talked about Paniolus.
Yes.
That has its own unique fingerprint, which is different than Gymnopolis, which is another entheogenic containing mushroom. Right. All of these in Agaricales, you know, which are Agaricus, basically any Amanita like mushroom.
Okay.
For all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
For interestingly enough, I don't know if I mentioned this before. One of the most interesting things about these entheogenic compounds, muscimol or Amanita mushrooms, you know, muscimol, ibotenic acid, muscarin, all of those mushrooms that have that, that's a very large family of mushrooms, genetically speaking, are the ancestors of all of the mushrooms that contain psilocybin.
No way.
So all the mushrooms that contain psilocybin that we're aware of right now lost muscimol and ibotenic acid production at some point genetically, historically, and then developed something else in its stead.
That's insane. So they said, we're going to produce this alkaloid called tryptamine instead of...
We're going to lean on this novel GABA compound that we found instead of this other thing. You know,
That's insane. I've never heard that.
It's interesting.
So
interesting,
you mapped that phylogeny.
That was mapped before me. That was mapped before me.
This definitely is already extant knowledge.
Yes. That was actually the first thing that I did my first blog post on for Critical Consulting, which is the blog that I did Understanding Entheogens
for
a little bit. And that was the first thing that I put out, was just looking at this paper and trying to like distill this very weird, complex phylogenetic paper into a TLDR. Long didn't read, you know?
Yeah, and that's the TLDR, is the Amanita, the Agaricales that contain ibotenic acid and muscimol eventually evolved into the mushrooms today that contain psilocybin. That's insane. I don't know how, I haven't heard this before. I've talked to Kevin Feeney, who wrote Fly Agaric. I've talked to people about psilocybin. No one's
It's in the weeds. It's very much in the weeds on the genetics.
Yeah. And there's unsung heroes doing this science that have not emerged yet from the mycelial underground.
Why I had to shout out Hartzinger.
Yes.
You know?
I mean, the colony of people just doing this work and putting out results. And so, I mean, there is a key role then in translating it. And it sounds like, I mean, Oakland Hyphae is kind of that translation to the masses.
The events that Reggie puts on are undeniably the most diverse and the most community-oriented. The conversations, we're bringing in people from high-level conversations. We're blessed to have the Shulgin Foundation come talk at some of my panels. But we were also blessed to have people like Shroomy Walkabouts, you know, Tony Alvarez, come in and Dicalones Hongos, Rob Lopez, come and talk as well. Like, both sides of the community there are coming in, like, you know, the hippie Burning Man Shulgin Farm folk are also coming in and meeting the Let's Walk in Nature Forage folk. And those are the people that are coming together. I mean, that's one of the things I love about Rob is every time, you know, Rob and Tomas go out foraging or I go out with them too, it's like, it's always a community meal.
Yeah.
Like, it's never not a thing.
That was funny hearing Tomas's story. He's like, I wasn't even about this foraging. And now I am like, this is my new, what I am addicted to. This is my path. So I love that. I love that it's grounded in community, but then you've also, you have taken ownership of kind of some of the more deep analytical chemistry education. So we've only got a few minutes left, but what is next directionally for you? I mean, this is already a lot of irons on the fire to keep these and grow these concepts. Yeah. So is it just pour more into this? Is there any other little pet projects you've got brewing or anything else you want to share?
The biggest thing that I'm going to be pouring into for 2024 is going to be Center for Mycological Analytics teaching courses. We're going to continue to teach out of Oakland, probably going to be teaching in the summer and the fall. We're going to be trying to teach in other locations next year as well. So again, working in Detroit during summertime, I think we're looking at May right now, tentatively. We'll, if you're interested, Center for Mycoanalytics.com.
Beautiful.
Is the website. You can find out more information about that. The Entheogen Genome Foundation, we're going to be doing a number of different publications, but we are currently actively looking to produce another research station. So we do research stations down in Mexico, and we've done pop-ups where we literally do DNA barcoding in the jungle. Like, oh, solar-powered, battery-powered, Starlink internet, you know, in a rainstorm. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And it's community building. We're going out on, and if you know anything about Alan Rockefeller, man goes hard in the paint when it comes to foraging. Like, you will lose him, or he will spend 3 hours in one spot taking 500 layered photos. of a single mushroom. And so, Entheogen Genome Foundations, we're going to be doing research stations where we're going to be inviting in members of the community to come with us to certain locations.
Yeah.
This year, I believe we're going to be talking about looking at working with our friends in Australia for Station 2. Station 1 has been centered in Mexico.
Okay.
And Station 2 is likely going to be centered in Australia because there's a number of different, I believe the correct term is Polynesian species.
Okay.
Psilocybe wereroa is from New Zealand, and it's an interesting species because there are people there that specifically state that if you consume enough of this, you will get wood lover's paralysis every time.
Wood lover's paralysis.
Which is a whole thing that's associated with entheogenic mushrooms where you're in a psychedelic state, but you're unable to physically move. And we have no idea what compound is doing it.
We don't know.
We have no idea. And so our goal is with this research station is to get a better understanding of the diversity of different fungi that are entheogenic in the Polynesian area, specifically based out of Tasmania initially, because wereroa occurs throughout the Polynesian area, but centered in New Zealand. But then there's also subaeruginosa and all these other different wood mother species like alenii or cyanescens, which are very likely subspecies of subaeruginosa, according to one gentleman who's based out of Australia's research, who was going to lead a lot of this discussion.
And of course, you guys picking, you know, islands in Oceania is the spot for fungi. I had an interview with Brian Perry, who talked about that, his career spanning those islands and what was left to be discovered. Super exciting. So we've only got a couple minutes left for KPCA listeners, for podcast listeners, you know Ian, you know Oakland Hyphy. For KPCA listeners, highly recommend you check out their work. If mushrooms, especially the idea of psychedelic mushrooms, piques your interest at all, to me, this is kind of the bleeding edge of this community conversation, of the science as well around this. So definitely go check out Oakland Hyphy, Center for Mycological Analytics. But for Ian, as a wrap up, what has this journey been like for you? Because when we first spoke, I don't know if you were linked in with Alan Rockefeller going to research stations in Mexico. So to turn from kind of chemist to now you're embedded in like culture and doing exciting, what's that been like?
Surreal. I can honestly say that it's like I remember watching people like listening to Dr. Carl Hart on other podcasts and then having him come up to me after a talk in Minnesota at Big Sykes, a psychedelics event where we were able to present. After I gave my presentation, he came up to me to talk to me about it. And it was mind-boggling to have somebody have that kind of input and then taking it to heart. Yeah. You know, I mean, pun unintended. But listening to what he had to say and really doing my best to embody the different perspectives, it's been surreal to meet people I never thought I would meet and to be able to have them know who I am and have respect for the work I do. My hope is to build a framework for people to feel as empowered as I've been able to feel, which is why I'm blessed to sit across from you in this gorgeous space, this community built space that I've seen you grow from. You know, it's amazing to see. I met Reggie. He sat next to Tomas at a Decrim Nature meeting that I convinced Tomas to go to back when I was still working in the cannabis industry. And it's been a roller coaster ride from Jamaica to the cups to seeing companies rise and fall from the work that we helped build to us succeed in the ways that we have been.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I know Reggie's currently in LA, in Las Vegas right now at Remind talking to people. Again, it's like, it's a roller coaster ride to see the people that the community that we've uplifted. Tomas.
Yeah.
To see my brother go from a guy I convinced to go to this meeting to now having the mycozine.
Yeah.
You know, it's surreal.
Yeah.
To see community grow, to literally sit across from you. I remember when we were doing something similar to this in the back house. You know, it's like there's something to be said about watching each other grow and sticking around for it. Like I'm on borrowed time. Like I'm on extra time right now. I feel like I'm blessed to be able to be alive in this moment. Blessed to have been able to accomplish the things I've been able to do. But I stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, it's like, and this is the biggest thing that I want to uplift people onto my shoulders next.
What a beautiful message. And mycology is such an amazing space to find people doing just that and giving deference and appreciating those that came before, and to steal a little wisdom from Will Padilla's last interview, to work with people from the past and in the future, consciously building something. It's an amazing thing to be a part of, and it is my great joy to get to speak with people like yourself. Ian, thank you so much for coming on The Mushroom Hour.
Love it and appreciate it, friend.